You're listening to KVMR FM, Nevada City. The time is 8:01 p.m. My name is T.E. Wolf. This is A Word in Edgewise. Tonight, we'll be hearing from the great Ray Bradbury and the almost equally great Neil Gaiman. A couple of stories about man's best friends. First a dog story, then a kitty story. For October, the beautiful and spooky time of year, when the dead are closest to us, they say. The Emissary. Martin knew it was autumn again, for Dog ran into the house bringing wind and frost and the smell of apples turned to cider under trees. In dark clock springs of hair, Dog fetched goldenrod, dust of farewell summer, acorn husk, hair of squirrel, feather of departed robin, sawdust from fresh-cut cordwood, and leaves like charcoals shaken from a blaze of wet maple trees. Dog jumped. Showers of brittle fern, blackberry vine, marsh grass sprang over the bed where Martin shouted. No doubt, no doubt of it at all, this incredible beast was October. Here, boy, here! And Dog settled to warm Martin's body with all the bonfires and subtle burnings of the season, to fill the room with soft or heavy, wet or dry odors of far traveling. In spring he smelled of lilac, iris, lawn-mowered grass. In summer, ice cream mustached, he came pungent with firecracker, Roman candle, pinwheel, baked by the sun. But autumn, autumn. Dog, what's it like outside? And lying there, Dog told as he always told. Lying there, Martin found autumn as in the old days, before the sickness bleached him white on his bed. Here was his contact, his carry-all. The quick-moving part of himself he sent with a yell to run and return, circle and scent, collect and deliver the time and texture of worlds in town, country, by creek, river, lake, down cellar, up attic, in closet or coal bin. 10 dozen times a day he was gifted with sunflower seed, cinder path, milkweed, horse chestnut, or full-flame smell of pumpkin. Through the loomings of the universe, Dog shuttled. The design was hid in his pelt. Put out your hand. It was there. And where did you go this morning? But he knew without hearing where Dog had rattled down hills, where autumn lay in cereal crispness, where children lay in funeral pyres, in rustling heaps, the leaf buried but watchful dead, as Dog and the world blew by. Martin trembled his fingers, searched the thick fur, read the long journey. Through stubbled fields, over glitters of ravine creek, down marbled spread of cemetery yard, into the woods. In the great season of spices and rare incense, now Martin ran through his emissary, around, about, and home. The bedroom door opened. That dog of yours is in trouble again. Mother brought in a tray of fruit salad, cocoa, and toast, her blue eyes snapping. Mother, always digging places, dug a hole in Miss Tarkin's garden this morning. She's spittin' mad. That's the fourth hole he's dug there this week. Maybe he's looking for something. Fiddlesticks. He's too darn curious. If he doesn't behave himself, he'll be locked up. Martin looked at this woman as if she were a stranger. Oh, you wouldn't do that. How would I learn anything? How would I find things out if Dog didn't tell me? Mom's voice was quieter. Is that what he does? Tell you things? There's nothing I don't know when he goes out and round and back. Nothing I can't find out from him. They both sat looking at Dog and the dry strewings of mold and seed over the quilt. Well, if he'll just stop digging where he shouldn't, he can run all he wants, said Mother. Here, boy, here. And Martin snapped a tin note to the dog's collar. My owner is Martin Smith. 10 years old. Sick in bed. Visitors welcome. Dog barked. Mother opened the downstairs door and let him out. Martin sat listening. Far off and away, you could hear Dog run in the quiet autumn rain that was falling now. You could hear the barking jingling fade, rise, fade again as he cut down alley, over lawn, to fetch back Mr. Holloway and the oiled metallic smell of the delicate, snow-flaked interiored watches he repaired in his home shop. Or maybe he would bring Mr. Jacobs, the grocer, whose clothes were rich with lettuce, celery, tomatoes, and the secret tinned and hidden smell of the red demons stamped on cans of deviled ham. Mr. Jacobs and his unseen pink meat devils waved often from the yard below. Or Dog brought Mr. Jackson, Mrs. Gillespie, Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Holmes, any friend or near friend, encountered, cornered, begged, worried, and at last shepherded home for lunch or tea and biscuits. Now, listening, Martin heard Dog below, with footsteps moving in a light rain behind him. The downstairs bell rang. Mom opened the door, light voices murmured. Martin sat forward, face shining. The stair treads creaked. A young woman's voice laughed quietly. Miss Haight, of course, his teacher from school. The bedroom door sprang open. Martin had company. Morning, afternoon, evening, dawn and dusk, sun and moon circled with Dog, who faithfully reported temperatures of turf and air, color of earth and tree, consistency of mist or rain, but most important of all, brought back again and again and again, Miss Haight. On Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, she baked Martin orange-iced cupcakes, brought him library books about dinosaurs and cavemen. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, somehow he beat her at dominoes. Somehow she lost at checkers, and soon, she cried, he'd defeat her handsomely at chess. On Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they talked and never stopped talking. She was so young and laughing and handsome, with her hair was so soft, shining brown like the season outside the window. She walked a clear, clean, and quick. A heartbeat warm in the bitter afternoon when he heard it. Above all, she had the secret of signs. She could read and interpret Dog and the symbols she searched out and plucked forth from his coat with her miraculous fingers. Eyes shut, softly laughing, in a gypsy's voice, she divined the world from the treasures in her hands. And on Monday afternoon, Miss Haight was dead. Martin sat up in bed slowly. Dead? He whispered. Dead, said his mother. Yes, dead. Killed in an auto accident a mile out of town. Dead, yes. Dead, which meant cold to Martin. Which meant silence and whiteness. And winter come long before its time. Dead, silent, cold, white. The thoughts circled round, blew down, and settled in whispers. Martin held Dog, thinking, turned to the wall. The lady with the autumn-colored hair, the lady with the laughter that was very gentle and never made fun, and the eyes that watched your mouth to see everything you ever said. The other half of Autumn lady, who told what was left untold by Dog about the world. The heartbeat at the still center of gray afternoon. The heartbeat fading. Mom? What do they do in the graveyard, Mom? Under the ground? Just lay there? Lie there. They just lie there? Is that all they do? Doesn't sound like much fun. For goodness sake, Martin, it's not made out to be fun. Why don't they jump up and run around once in a while if they get tired lying there? God's pretty silly. Martin! Well, you'd think he'd treat people better than to tell them to lie still for keeps. That's impossible. Nobody can do it. I tried once. Dog tries. I tell him, dead dog. He plays dead a while and gets sick and tired and wags his tail or opens one eye and looks at me, bored. Boy, I bet sometimes those graveyard people do the same thing, huh? Huh, dog? Dog barked. Be still with that kind of talk, said Mother. Martin looked off into space. Bet that's exactly what they do, he said. Autumn burnt the trees bare and ran Dog still farther around, fording creek, prowling graveyard, as was his custom, and back in the dusk to fire off volleys of barking that shook windows wherever he turned. In the late last days of October, Dog began to act as if the wind had changed and blew from a strange country. He stood quivering on the porch below. He whined, his eyes fixed at the empty land beyond town. Brought no visitors for Martin. He stood for hours each day as if leashed, trembling, then shot away straight as if someone had called. Each night he returned later, with no one following. Each night, Martin sank deeper and deeper into his pillow. Well, people are busy, said Mother. They haven't time to notice the tag Dog carries. Or they mean to come visit, but they forget. But there was more to it than that. There was the fevered shining in Dog's eyes, and his whimpering tick late at night in some private dream. His shivering in the dark under the bed. The way he sometimes stood half the night looking at Martin as if some great and impossible secret was his and he knew no way to tell it save by savagely thumping his tail or turning in endless circles, never to lie down, spinning and spinning again. Thank you. October 30th. Dog ran out and didn't come back at all, even when, after supper, Martin heard his parents call and call. The hour grew late. The streets and sidewalks stood empty. The air moved cold about the house, and there was nothing. Nothing. Long after midnight, Martin lay watching the world beyond the cool, clear glass windows, and there was not even autumn, for there was no dog to fetch it in. There would be no winter, for who could bring the snow to melt in your hands? Father? Mother? No, not the same. They couldn't play the game with its special secrets and rules, its sounds and pantomimes. No more seasons, no more time. The go-between, the emissary, was lost to the wild throngings of civilization. Poisoned, stolen, hit by a car, left somewhere in a culvert. Sobbing, Martin turned his face to his pillow. The world was a picture under glass, untouchable. The world was dead. Martin twisted in bed, and in 3 days the last Halloween pumpkins were rotting in trash cans. Papier-mâché skulls and witches were burnt on bonfires, and ghosts were stacked on shelves with other linens until next year. To Martin, Halloween had been nothing more than one evening when tin horns cried off in the cold autumn stars. Children blew like goblin leaves along the flinty walks, flinging their heads or cabbages at porches, soap-writing names or similar magic symbols on icy windows. All of it as distant, unfathomable, and nightmarish as a puppet show seen from so many miles away that there is no sound or meaning. For 3 days in November, Martin watched alternate light and shadow sift across his ceiling. The fire pageant was over forever. Autumn lay in cold ashes. Martin sank deeper, yet deeper, in white marble layers of bed, motionless, listening, always listening. Friday evening, his parents kissed him goodnight and walked out of the house into the hushed cathedral weather toward a motion picture show. Miss Tarkins from next door stayed on in the parlor below until Martin called down he was sleepy, and she took her knitting off home. In silence, Martin lay, following the great move of stars down a clear and moonlit sky, remembering nights such as this when he'd spanned the town with dog ahead, behind, around, about, tracking the green plush ravine, lapping slumberous streams gone milky with the fullness of the moon, leaping cemetery tombstones while whispering the marble names. On, quickly on, through shaved meadows where the only motion was the off-on quivering of stars, to streets where shadows would not stand aside for you, but crowded all the sidewalks for mile on mile. Run, now run, chasing, being chased by bitter smoke, fog, mist, wind, ghost of mind, fright of memory. Home, safe, sound, snug, warm, asleep. Nine o'clock. Chime. The drowsy clock in the deep stairwell below. Chime. Dog, come home and run the world with you. Dog, bring a thistle with frost on it. Bring nothing else but the wind. Dog, where are you? Oh, listen now. I'll call. Martin held his breath. Way off somewhere, a sound. Martin rose up, trembling. There again, the sound. So small a sound, like a sharp needle point brushing the sky long miles and many miles away. The dreamy echo of a dog, barking. The sound of a dog crossing fields and farms, dirt roads and rabbit paths, running, letting out great barks of steam, cracking the night. The sound of a circling dog which came and went back as if the animal were kept by someone on a fantastically long chain. As if the dog were running and someone whistled under the chestnut trees in mold shadow, tar shadow, moon shadow, walking, and the dog circled back and sprang out again toward home. Dog, Martin thought. Oh, dog, come home. Come home. Come home, boy. Listen. Oh, listen, where you been? Come on, boy, make tracks. 5, 10, 15 minutes. Near, very near, the bark, the sound. Martin cried out, thrust his feet from the bed, leaned to the window. Dog! Listen, boy, dog! Dog! He said it over and over. Dog! Wicked dog! Run off and gone all these days. Bad dog! Good dog! Home, boy, hurry, and bring what you can. Near now, near. Up the street, barking. To knock clappered house fronts with sound, whirl iron cocks on rooftops in the moon, firing off volleys. Dog! Now at the door below. Martin shivered. Should he run? Let dog in or wait for mom and dad? Wait, oh God, wait. But what if dog ran off again? No, he'd go down, snatch the door wide, yell, grab dog in, and run upstairs so fast, laughing, crying, holding him tight that... Dog stopped barking. Martin almost broke the window, jerking to it. Silence. As if someone had told dog to hush now, hush. A full minute passed. Martin clenched his fist. Below, a faint whimpering. Then, slowly, the downstairs front door opened. Someone was kind enough to have opened the door for dog. Of course. Dog had brought Mr. Jacobs or Mr. Gillespie or Miss Tarkins or... The downstairs door shut. Dog raced upstairs, whining, flung himself on the bed. Dog, dog, where you been? Where have you done? Dog, dog! And he crushed dog hard and long to himself, weeping. Dog, dog! He laughed and shouted, Dog! But after a moment he stopped laughing and crying, suddenly. He pulled back away. He held the animal and looked at him, eyes widening. The odor coming from dog was different. It was a smell of strange earth. It was a smell of night within night. A smell of digging down deep in shadow through earth that had lain cheek by jowl with things that were long hidden and decayed. The stinking and rancid soil fell away in clods of dissolution from dog's muzzle and paws. He had dug deep. He had dug very deep indeed. That was it, wasn't it? Wasn't it? What kind of message was this from dog? What could such a message mean? The stench, the ripe and awful cemetery earth. Dog was a bad dog, digging where he shouldn't. Dog was a good dog, always making friends. Dog loved people. Dog brought them home. And now, moving up the dark hall stairs at intervals, came the sound of feet, one foot dragged after the other, painfully. Slowly, slowly. Dog shivered. A rain of strange night earth fell seething on the bed. Dog turned. The bedroom door whispered in, Martin had company. The price. Tramps and vagabonds have marks they make on gateposts and trees and doors, letting others of their kind know a little bit about the people who live at the houses and farms they pass on their travels. I think cats must leave similar signs. How else to explain the cats who turn up at our door throughout the year, hungry and flea-ridden and abandoned? We take them in. We get rid of the fleas and the ticks, feed them, and take them to the vet. We pay for them to get their shots, and indignity upon indignity, we have them neutered or spayed. And they stay with us for a few months, or for a year, or forever. Most of them arrive in summer. We live in the country, just the right distance out of town for the city dwellers to abandon their cats near us. We never seem to have more than 8 cats, rarely have fewer than 3. The cat population of my house is currently as follows. Hermione and Pod, Tabby and Black, respectively, the mad sisters who live in my attic office and do not mingle. Snowflake, the blue-eyed, long-haired white cat who lived wild in the woods for years before she gave up her wild ways for soft sofas and beds. And last but largest, Furball, Snowflake's cushion-like, calico, long-haired daughter, orange and black and white, whom I discovered as a tiny kitten in our garage one day, strangled and almost dead, her head poked through an old badminton net, and who surprised us all by not dying, but instead growing up to be the best-natured cat I have ever encountered. And then there is the Black Cat, who has no other name than the Black Cat, and who turned up almost a month ago. We did not realize he was going to be living here at first. He looked too well-fed to be a stray, too old and jaunty to have been abandoned. He looked like a small panther, and he moved like a patch of night. One day in the summer, he was lurking about our ramshackle porch, 8 or 9 years old at a guess, male, greenish-yellow of eye, very friendly, quite unperturbable. I assumed he belonged to a neighboring farmer or household. I went away for a few weeks to finish writing a book, and when I came home, he was still on our porch, living in an old cat bed one of the children had found for him. He was, however, almost unrecognizable. Patches of fur had gone, and there were deep scratches on his gray skin. The tip of one ear was chewed away. There was a gash beneath one eye, a slice gone from one lip. He looked tired and thin. We took the Black Cat to the vet, where we got him some antibiotics, which we fed him each night along with soft cat food. We wondered who he was fighting. Snowflake, our beautiful, white, near-feral queen? Raccoons? A rat-tailed, fanged possum? Each night the scratches would be worse. One night his side would be chewed up. The next it would be his underbelly, raked with bloody claw marks, bloody to the touch. When it got to that point, I took him down to the basement to recover beside the furnace and the piles of boxes. He was surprisingly heavy, the Black Cat. I picked him up and carried him down there with a cat basket and a litter box, some food and water. closed the door behind me. I had to wash the blood from my hands when I left the basement. He stayed down there for 4 days. At first he seemed too weak to feed himself. A cut beneath one eye had rendered him almost one-eyed. He limped and lolled weakly, thick yellow pus oozing from the cut in his lip. I went down there every morning and every night, and I fed him, gave him antibiotics, which I mixed with his canned food. I dabbed at the worst of the cuts and spoke to him. He had diarrhea, and although I changed his litter daily, the basement stank evilly. The 4 days that the black cat lived in the basement were a bad 4 days in my house. The baby slipped in the bath and banged her head and might have drowned. I learned that a project I had set my heart on, adapting Hope Merley's novel Lud in the Mist for the BBC, was no longer going to happen, and I realized that I did not have the energy to begin again from scratch, pitching it to other networks or to other media. My daughter left for summer camp and immediately began to send home a plethora of heart-tearing letters and cards, 5 or 6 each day, imploring us to bring her home. My son had some kind of fight with his best friend to the point that they were no longer on speaking terms, and returning home one night, my wife hit a deer that ran out in front of the car. The deer was killed, the car was left undrivable, and my wife sustained a small cut over one eye. By the 4th day, the cat was prowling the basement, walking haltingly but impatiently between the stacks of books and comics, the boxes of mail and cassettes, of pictures and of gifts and of stuff. He mewed at me to let him out, and reluctantly, I did so. He went back onto the porch and slept there for the rest of the day. The next morning there were deep, new gashes in his flanks, and clumps of black cat hair, his, covered the wooden boards of the porch. Letters arrived that day from my daughter telling us that camp was going better, and she thought that she could survive a few days. My son and his friends sorted out their problem, although what the argument was about, trading cards, computer games, Star Wars, or a girl, I would never learn. The BBC executive who had vetoed Lud in the Mist was discovered to have been taking bribes, well, questionable loans, from an independent production company and was sent home on permanent leave. His successor, I was delighted to learn when she faxed me, was the woman who had initially proposed the project to me before leaving the BBC. I thought about returning the black cat to the basement, but decided against it. Instead, I resolved to try and discover what kind of animal was coming to our house each night, and from there to formulate a plan of action, to trap it, perhaps. For birthdays and at Christmas, my family gives me gadgets and gizmos, pricey toys which excite my fancy, but ultimately rarely leave their boxes. There is a food dehydrator and an electric carving knife, a bread-making machine, and last year's present, a pair of see-in-the-dark binoculars. On Christmas Day, I had put the batteries into binoculars and walked around the basement in the dark, too impatient even to wait until nightfall, stalking a flock of imaginary starlings. You were warned not to turn it on in the light. That would have damaged the binoculars and quite possibly your eyes as well. Afterward, I had put the device back into its box, and it sat there still in my office, beside the box of computer cables and forgotten bits and pieces. Perhaps, I thought, if the creature, dog or cat or raccoon or what have you, were to see me sitting on the porch, it would not come. So I took a chair into the box and coat room, little larger than a closet, which overlooks the porch, and when everyone in the house was asleep, I went out onto the porch and bade the black cat good night. "That cat," my wife had said when he first arrived, "is a person." And there was something very person-like in his huge leonine face, his broad black nose, his greenish-yellow eyes, his fanged but amiable mouth, still leaking amber pus from the right lower lip. I stroked his head and scratched him beneath the chin and wished him well. And I went inside, turned off the light on the porch. I sat on my chair in the darkness inside the house, with the sea-in-the-dark binoculars on my lap. I'd switched the binoculars on, and a trickle of greenish light came from the eyepieces. Time passed in the darkness. I experimented with looking at the darkness through the binoculars, learning to focus, to see the world in shades of green. I found myself horrified by the number of swarming insects I could see in the night air. It was as if the night world were some kind of nightmarish soup swimming with life. Then I lowered the binoculars from my eyes and stared out at the rich blacks and blues of the night, empty and peaceful and calm. Time passed. I struggled to keep awake, found myself profoundly missing cigarettes and coffee, my two lost addictions. Either of them would have kept my eyes open, but before I had tumbled too far into the world of sleep and dreams, a yowl from the garden jerked me fully awake. I fumbled the binoculars to my eyes and was disappointed to see that it was merely Snowflake, the white cat, streaking across the front garden like a patch of greenish-white light. She vanished into the woodland to the left of the house and was gone. I was about to settle myself back down when it occurred to me to wonder what exactly had startled Snowflake so. I began scanning the middle distance with the binoculars, looking for a huge raccoon, a dog, or a vicious possum. And there was indeed something coming down the driveway toward the house. I could see it through the binoculars, clear as day. It was the devil. I had never seen the devil before, and although I had written about him in the past, if pressed, would have confessed that I had no belief in him other than as an imaginary figure, tragic and Miltonian. The figure coming up the driveway was not Milton's Lucifer. It was the devil. My heart began to pound in my chest, to pound so hard that it hurt. I hoped it could not see me, that in a dark house, behind window glass, I was hidden. The figure flickered and changed as it walked up the drive. One moment it was dark, bull-like, minotaurish. The next it was slim and female. And the next it was a cat itself, a scarred, huge, gray-green wild cat, its face contorted with hate. There are steps that lead up to my porch, four white wooden steps in need of a coat of paint. I knew they were white, although they were, like everything else, green through my binoculars. At the bottom of the steps, the devil stopped and called out something that I could not understand, three, perhaps four words in a whining, howling language that must have been old and forgotten when Babylon was young. And although I did not understand the words, I felt the hairs rise on the back of my head as it called. And then I heard, muffled through the glass but still audible, a low growl, a challenge, and slowly, steadily, a black figure walked down the steps of the house away from me toward the devil. These days the black cat no longer moved like a panther. Instead he stumbled and rocked like a sailor only recently returned to land. The devil was a woman now. She said something soothing and gentle to the cat in a tongue that sounded like French and reached out a hand to him. He sank his teeth into her arm, and her lips curled, and she spat at him. The woman glanced up at me then. If I had doubted that she was the devil before, I was certain of it now. The woman's eyes flashed red fire at me, but you can see no red through the night vision binoculars, only shades of green. And the devil saw me through the window. It saw me. I am in no doubt about that at all. The devil twisted and writhed, and now it was some kind of a jackal, flat-faced, huge-headed, bull-necked creature, halfway between a hyena and a dingo. There were maggots squirming in its mangy fur, and began to walk up the steps. The black cat leapt upon it, and in seconds, they became a rolling, writhing thing, moving faster than my eyes could follow. All this in silence. And then a low roar. Down the country road at the bottom of our drive in the distance lumbered a late-night truck, its blazing headlights burning bright as green suns through the binoculars. I lowered them from my eyes and saw only darkness and the gentle yellow of headlights, and then the rear lights red as it vanished off again into the nowhere at all. When I raised the binoculars once more, there was nothing to be seen, only the black cat on the steps, staring up into the air. I trained the binoculars up and saw something flying away, a vulture perhaps, or an eagle, and then it flew beyond the trees and was gone. I went out onto the porch and picked up the black cat and stroked him and said kind, soothing things to him. He mewed piteously when I first approached him, but after a while he went to sleep on my lap. I put him in his basket, went upstairs to my bed to sleep myself. There was dried blood on my t-shirt and jeans the following morning. That was a week ago. The thing that comes to my house does not come every night, but it comes most nights. We know it by the wounds on the cat, and the pain I can see in those leonine eyes. He has lost the use of his front left paw. His right eye is closed for good. I wonder what we did to deserve the black cat. I wonder who sent him. I'm selfish and scared. I wonder how much more he has to give. Time is 8:57 p.m. You're listening to KVMR-FM, Nevada City. My name is T.E. Wolf. This has been A Word in Edgewise. Reading The Emissary by Ray Bradbury and The Price by Neil Gaiman. I want to dedicate this show to a couple of friends of mine who have passed. My friend Amber, my black four-legged leonine friend Hussein, several years back. Angels, both of them. As we all should be. Coming up next is Old Radio Theater, and I'll be back in 2 weeks for a couple of very freaky stories.